sleeping in public is considered conduct. And this court in Clark discussed that is conduct. Also, the federal regulations
sleeping is a biological necessity. It's sort of like breathing. I mean, you could say breathing is conduct, too. But presumably, you would not think that it's okay to criminalize breathing in public.
I would like to point to the federal regulations.
And for a homeless person who has no place to go, sleeping in public is kind of like breathing in public.
Supreme Court Justice Elena Kagan earlier today questioning Theony Evangelos. She's the attorney representing the city of Grants Pass, Oregon, in a big case that could completely upend how California responds to its homelessness crisis. After 2.5 hours of oral arguments, the justices seemed divided along ideological lines about punishing people whom they say have no choice but to sleep outside, and making sure that cities and states have the flexibility to respond to homelessness in a way that works best for them. Federal courts have repeatedly ruled that if a city does not have enough shelter beds for its homeless population, then it cannot stop people from sleeping on the streets, because that would violate the Eighth Amendment's ban on cruel and unusual punishment. Governor Gavin Newsom said today the Supreme Court has an opportunity to, quote, strike a balance. In the past, he has said these lower court rulings make it harder to clear encampments on sidewalks and parks and under freeways across California. Jessica Levinson joins me now. She's Press Play's legal and a professor at Loyola Law School, and she monitored today's arguments. Hello.
I sure did. Last week of Supreme Court oral arguments for the term.
Oh, wow. So in any other term, this would be probably the biggest case, but there are lots of others. We're going to talk about one later in the week that involves President or ex-President Trump. But let's get to this one. Before we get to the arguments, let's talk about what this case was about. If you could give us a quick rundown. It came from the small city in Southern Oregon called Grants Pass.
Well, that's right. But the reason, of course, that we're talking about this case is that Grants Pass has an ordinance that looks a lot like other ordinances throughout towns and cities and counties, really across the United States. And about 10 years ago, they started enforcing an ordinance that makes it illegal to sleep on sidewalks and streets by using blankets and cardboard boxes and showing some intent to, quote, set up a temporary place to sleep there. And what happens is if you get caught and you violate the ordinance, then first you are fined, and then you are fined a little bit more, and then you are told to leave. And then if you don't leave, you can actually be subject to criminal trespass charges. And so this case went up to the Ninth Circuit based on a previous ruling that you talked about. The Ninth Circuit said, we think that this amounts to cruel and unusual punishment, in part, and I'm sure we'll get into this, because what you are doing, Grants Pass, is you're actually punishing people based on their status, that they are homeless, not based on their conduct. And that's what's not okay under a different Supreme Court case.
Okay, so that Supreme Court case came from decades ago, basically the middle of the 20th century. It's called Robinson v. California, and it involved drug use. So talk about that one and how that is precedent for today's case.
So it's amazing how these old cases that probably nobody expected that they would come up in this scenario just loom so large under these new fact patterns. And so what happened is, as you said, it's a 1962 case, and it was a case involving a California law. And what the court said is basically you can't punish people for being drug addicts because that's a status, but you can punish people for their conduct. You can't buy drugs, you can't possess drugs, you can't sell drugs. All of that is conduct. And that's why we have this focus, or maybe it seemed to people like almost hyper-focus on what's actually going on here. Are we punishing people because homelessness is, in fact, an involuntary, in most cases, status? Or are we punishing people because they're deciding to sleep on the streets, which is conduct? And as you can imagine, it's almost like looking at the same question just with two different prisms. And you could answer yes to both of those questions.
There was an earlier decision also out of the Ninth Circuit, which concerned Boise, Idaho. It was a very similar case. And cities have complained that they have been handcuffed, basically, by this decision. So how does this case compare to the one out of Boise, Idaho?
So very similar. The penalties are somewhat different. In Boise, the criminal penalties were upfront earlier, so to speak. In this case, it's first civil fines, then move along. And then if all of those things don't happen, you can be subject to a charge of criminal trespass. But that case is absolutely one that will, frankly, I think, live or die on what the Supreme Court decides to do, because that was a 2018 case. And the Ninth Circuit did say that Idaho could not implement a very similar law, a very similar anti-camping law, because what they said is sleeping on the streets when there's no other place to go, and punishing people for doing that, again, it violates this prohibition against cruel and unusual punishment, something we don't typically talk about, that's under the Eighth Amendment.
Okay, so let's get to today's arguments. We heard Justice Kagan arguing that sleeping is a biological necessity, and that if you are experiencing homelessness and have no place to go, sleeping in public is really a lot like breathing in public. How can you criminalize that? What did the city say in response to that?
I don't know, frankly, that they had a great direct response to that. What they were really saying is that breathing is something where you have no choice. And when it comes to where you will sleep, even if there's not any sort of accommodations or any shelters where you are, I think the idea, and this is in the legislative history of Grants Pass, is then maybe you should move along and go somewhere else. And, you know, to take a step back, that's part of what this ordinance is really about, is to try and ensure that homeless people don't stay in Grants Pass. And what you heard is, and I think you even played that portion of the tape, where Justice Kagan said, but breathing could be seen as, you know, breathing, sleeping, all of these things could be seen as conduct. And Justice Sonia Sotomayor said something very similar, and in fact, even went harder and said, well, so what are homeless people to do? This is the basis of their ability to exist. It's a biological need. And I'm not sure the city directly responded to that so much as said, don't take this tool outside of our toolkit. We have broad police powers, and this is one of the ways that we want to try and attack the homelessness crisis.
Okay, let me play a clip from Chief Justice John Roberts, and he's asking a lawyer for the Biden administration. And Biden administration, by the way, has apparently taken kind of a middle ground on this whole case. And basically, the Chief Justice is asking about why such complicated policy questions should be left in the hands of the courts.
And it's a policy problem because the solution, of course, is to build shelter, to provide shelter for those who are otherwise harmless. But municipalities have competing priorities. I mean, what if there are lead pipes in the water? Do you build the homeless shelter or do you take care of the lead pipes? What is there isn't enough fire protection? Which one do you prioritize? Why would you think that these nine people are the best people to judge and weigh those policy judgments?
So what do you hear there? Is that a way for Roberts to not, and maybe the majority on the court, to not take a position pro or con, but to say, look, this is better left up to municipalities to decide?
Well, which, of course, is a position in and of itself. But I hear something that you've heard the justices say, frankly, for centuries. I just finished teaching constitutional law. The very first day I put up a slide and it said, what is the judge's role? And that's what I hear him saying. And that's what I hear in a very typically conservative way, and I mean legal conservative, saying, I think this is best left up to elected officials. Now, of course, we all know that the conclusion there is that that sometimes blesses certain policies. But that is something that the justices said, frankly, when it came to abortion rights, and when it comes to a lot of different questions, they say not it. And particularly when it comes to something so politically fraught like this, I think what's fascinating is the conservative justices, you really heard them focusing on, what are we going to do to the city? Are we going to overly limit the city and their broad powers to combat homelessness? And then the liberal justices, I think, much more focus on what is going to happen to the individuals sleeping on the streets. Both of those groups are very important, just different focuses from the justices on really how to look at this question.
Was there any back and forth on what happens if you do side with Grants Pass and this idea of where would people who are experiencing homelessness, where would they go? Was there any concern on the part of the justices that, okay, if you did side with Grants Pass, would you then have to also require the city to buy, to build more temporary housing or permanent housing for people experiencing homelessness?
Absolutely. There was more policy, frankly, than we typically hear from the justices about, okay, what happens next? And this is also something that was brought up in a number of the amicus briefs, and you heard a little bit in oral arguments, which is this policy actually even effective, and or is it anything other than counterproductive? Because we can imagine if you're homeless, you don't have a lot of money to pay a fine, and you don't have a lot of money to pay a fine that escalates, and you may not have an ability to easily be geographically mobile. And so the idea is that these fines hurt people's credit, they follow them from place to place, and it makes it difficult to try and solve the problem we're trying to solve, which is allow people to get cars and apartments and jobs. And so there was, to your question, more on what actually happens, what is the consequence? And frankly, I think the different factions of the court are worried about different consequences here.
Okay. And a ruling would come when?
Right around the end of June. This term may go into the first week of July, but I can't imagine we will be having this conversation after July 4th.
All right. Jessica Levinson, Press Play's Legal Eagle and a professor at Loyola Law School. Thank you.
Thank you.
How a private company bought up water rights in rural Arizona and is selling that water to an expanding city. And a train from Southern California to Las Vegas will be the nation's first bullet train. It broke ground today. Those stories are coming up next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on 89.9 KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Nestled along the banks of the Colorado River in the tiny town of Cibola, Arizona, there is a massive battle over water rights playing out. A decade ago, a private company came to this town and bought nearly 500 acres of farmland. And it initially used that land to grow alfalfa and cotton. But that company wasn't really in the farming business. It was in the water business. And in 2018, the company sold the rights to its Colorado River water to a Phoenix suburb, hundreds of miles away. It appears to be the first time a private company has transferred water rights on the Colorado River for profit. And the move was initially approved by the Department of the Interior. That has led to a lot of legal confusion and fears that Arizona could see the same kind of water grab that L.A. did in the Owens Valley a century ago. Joining me now to talk about this is Manvi Singh, a reporter for The Guardian U.S. Hello.
Hello, Madeline. Thanks so much for having me.
Great to have you. All right. Cibola, it's a tiny town, right? Just a couple of hundred people live there.
Yeah, it's a super tiny town right across the border from California in western Arizona. You'll basically see lots of fields of alfalfa, like dusty roads, but also a nature preserve and this really interesting landscape that's kind of this combination of a desert and a riparian ecosystem right by the Colorado River.
And so 10 years ago or so, a company called Greenstone Resource Partners, LLC, came in and bought hundreds of acres of farmland. And what did it do next?
So for a while, it just leased the farmland back to farmers who grew alfalfa and cotton. And they bought this land through this sort of like innocuously named LLC called GSC Farms. And so no one really paid it much attention. And then in 2018, they struck a deal with this town called Queen Creek in the suburbs of Phoenix, which is a super like fast-growing, fast-developing suburb. You just see like all kinds of construction in the works if you'd go there right now, really booming. And they struck a deal to sell the water rights. They let the farmland go fallow, and the water is now flowing through the taps in Queen Creek.
So was it all a cover in the first place to buy this land and lease it back to the farmers?
I mean, I guess not quite. I can't really, you know, talk to the intentions of Greenstone here. But, you know, Greenstone and a couple of other companies like it that are really in the business of brokering water, you know, this is really part of their business model. It can take a long time to sell water. There's a lot of bureaucracy. And, you know, in some cases, they might want to kind of wait for the right moment in the market to make that kind of sale. And so in the meantime, they will lease the land to farmers because that's good business. You know, it's good for taxes and tax purposes. It's also just good to like make a little bit of money until you make that sale.
And how does Greenstone describe itself?
It describes itself as a water company. It talks about how they're here to get water to the people and communities that need it. And they have bought thousands of acres of farmland, not just in Cibola, but in, you know, other parts of Arizona. And they've brokered already a number of deals, mostly for groundwater or Rio Grande water, where they've gotten water to communities that are developing or, you know, in one case, a data center that needed water supply. They really see themselves as kind of connecting the development community to the water that they need in this increasingly dry and water-scarce Western landscape.
But I guess why do these leasing it back to the farmers to grow alfalfa and cotton when your ultimate goal is to sell the water to like a suburb? You know, why not just do that from the outset?
It takes a while. There's like a lot of bureaucracy, especially when you're dealing with Colorado River water. You have to go through kind of a number of approvals through the State Department of Water Resources and then the Bureau of Reclamation. It just takes a long time. And in the meantime, you know, taxes on farmland are lower and getting rent from farmers just kind of makes business sense. And so that's kind of the business model. Until they sell, why not kind of also make use of that land by leasing it?
Okay. So that water is now flowing to Queen Creek. And I guess that means it's not flowing to the farms. So what does it look like now there?
When I went last year, it was just like dry, you know, it's just a bunch of dyed back cotton, you know, the sort of vibe of like, if you were in a cartoon, you'd see a tumbleweed going by. I didn't actually see a tumbleweed, but that was sort of the feeling. And for the people who lived around that area, it really came as a shock because they did not know that this farm was really part of this water business.
So this all sounds familiar if we know our Los Angeles history. But I guess back then, at the beginning of the 20th century, when the farmers in the Owens River Valley also were shocked that their water was being diverted to create Los Angeles, they were also, I don't know, deceived in a way. Is it a similar story? I'm not trying to accuse this company of deception, but are there similar tactics going on?
Yeah, I guess in a way, a lot of locals in Cibola and some of those other rural counties in Western Arizona, they do reference Owens Valley a lot. And that is really their fear that like they're going to be left in the dust while these booming suburbs are going to get all of their water. I guess there's also the similarity in that, yeah, locals didn't really know it was going on. You know, I can't speak to their intent of deception. They also did not respond to multiple attempts for me to get in touch with them and kind of get their side of the story. But yeah, there's definitely that comparison. I would say what is a little bit different and kind of threatening to locals in a different way, maybe, is the fact that this is a corporation. You know, this isn't exactly like Owens Valley in that these are private companies that are going in and buying up all this land. I think a lot of local officials, as well as, you know, state level or even at the federal level, are worried that as governments try to negotiate and figure out how are we going to deal with drought, how are we going to deal with water scarcity, and decide, you know, where to allocate how much water, we're doing all these complicated negotiations, they're worried that these private companies are sort of intercepting into that process. They're coming in just as water is getting more and more difficult to come by, and they're offering to sell it to the highest bidder. And that, you know, really throws a wrench in these very complicated negotiations we're in the middle of, in terms of like how we're going to use the Colorado River.
But doesn't the federal government have to approve the sale of this water, the transfer of this water?
Yeah, the federal government does have to give a final approval if it's off the Colorado River. It does not have to give the approval in every case of a water transfer. So it really depends on, you know, whether this is part of a federal project or if it's, you know, a state level thing. But yeah, a number of rural counties in Arizona have sued the Bureau of Reclamation over this transfer and the fact that they allowed the transfer to happen. And the crux of their argument is like Reclamation really didn't do a thorough enough job of assessing the environmental impact, because they didn't really consider the fact that this might be the first of many transfers. So they maybe looked at this like one really narrow case of like 2,000 acre feet of water, and they're like, oh, whatever, that's nothing in the grand scheme of things. But what a lot of local officials are saying, and they're really backed by like Arizona's attorney general in this, is, you know, they're saying this is a test case. Like, these companies own thousands of acres of land, and they have lots of water rights attached to that that they want to sell. And it's one thing if you sell like the water off of one parcel of farmland, but if you keep doing that over and over, of course that's going to have an environmental impact. And so a judge earlier this year actually remanded Reclamation to do a more thorough environmental evaluation. And kind of we're waiting on the outcome of that to see what's going to happen in terms of like how this will influence future attempts to transfer water in this way.
Hmm. Well, so I guess this does, water rights are becoming quite valuable as water dries up because of climate change and the droughts. So these battles are just going to become more intense?
Yeah, I think that's what a lot of water experts I spoke to really believe. You know, we are using more water than we have. You know, for example, in Arizona, the suburbs of Phoenix are now limited in their development because that region is running out of groundwater. And so places like Queen Creek and other suburbs of Phoenix, which are really some of the fastest growing metro areas in the country, are having to figure out ways to import water. And that's really creating a lot of pressure for them to like look for water from these private companies, from other communities, from farmland, to make it work and really keep up with the pace of development. And, you know, as we know, the Colorado River is, as it's declining, the states that are using this water are really deadlocked in negotiations of how and where they're going to cut down their use. And so if you have this kind of grandfathered in high priority water right off the Colorado River, that is extremely valuable. That's a lot more than a lot of cities can say or lay claim to.
Mm. So I guess there are companies that go in and they're just like looking at old land grants and deeds and all that kind of stuff to see who owns what in terms of water rights and seeing if they're willing to sell. And I guess it must be a burgeoning business.
Yeah, basically, a lot of these people who work at these companies have backgrounds in water. They've studied water law. They've worked for other companies that specialize in water transactions. You know, I think part of what is really interesting and also, you know, maybe beneficial to the business model of these companies is water rights are like so incredibly complicated. I've reported on this for months and months, and it still just like makes my head hurt. It's really hard to know like how to transfer water. There's so many levels of bureaucracy. It can really depend on which county you're in and which irrigation district. And there's all these like really arcane rules that are difficult to find. A lot of irrigation districts don't even have like websites, you know? And so you really have to be a specialist to know how to play this game.
Well, thank you so much for your reporting.
Thank you so much for having me on.
My pleasure. That's Manvi Singh. She covers the West Coast for The Guardian. Coming up, imagine getting to Las Vegas by train in just about 2 hours.
So many Americans have traveled abroad, seen what true high-speed rail is like, come back and said, why can't we have nice things like this? There is no reason why the United States can't have the best passenger rail in the world, but you get what you pay for.
The train from Rancho Cucamonga to Las Vegas will be the nation's first high-speed rail line. It broke ground today and is expected to be completed in time for the Olympics here in L.A. We'll talk about that next on Press Play. This is Press Play on 89.9 KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. For years, perhaps even decades, there has been a dream of high-speed trains that would link Los Angeles to Las Vegas. Well, today is the day that dream became a reality. In Vegas today, construction began on a train that would get travelers from Rancho Cucamonga in San Bernardino County to the Las Vegas Strip in just a little more than 2 hours, so about an hour less than driving from there. Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg shared his thoughts from the groundbreaking in Vegas this morning on CNBC.
Their aim is to be up and running by 2028 with a fast ride between here in Las Vegas, where we're standing, and Rancho Cucamonga in Southern California. That will really, I think, be a watershed moment, because I'm convinced that the first time Americans actually experience American high-speed rail on U.S. soil, there's going to be no going back.
Joining us with more is Noah Bierman, staff writer at the LA Times. Hello.
Hi.
All right. Tell us more about this bullet train. How fast is it going to go?
They're saying close to 200 miles an hour, which would make it the only true high-speed rail in the United States. They own another train with, they've just finished the final phase in Florida, which is considered, you know, higher speed rail, similar to the Acela in the northeastern United States. Those go over 100 miles, but not up to that, closer to that 200-mile-an-hour range.
And this is being built by a private company called Brightline West, which is building the Florida train?
Yeah, they built the Florida one, which I wrote a few months ago. And, you know, that one's up and running. They've spent a few years on a shorter link that was between Miami and West Palm Beach, about, you know, about an hour and a half ride. But they just completed the Miami to Orlando piece and opened that in the early fall. And that's what's been running for the last few months.
And what's it like?
Well, it's nicer than most travel experiences, I will say that.
That's a low bar. I'll just add that in.
But it's definitely, and the people you meet are really excited to be there, unlike when you're going on an airplane, that's for sure. But it's expensive, and so, you know, you have to pay for it. It it's comparable and in some ways more expensive than flying, depending on how you go. And definitely the train from Vegas will probably be more expensive than driving. They're talking about upwards of $200 each way.
Oh, wow. Okay. And so is that more expensive than taking a plane?
I think it will end up being more expensive. They consider their main competition the car. You know, they estimate about 50 million trips a year between L.A. and Southern California every year, with 85% of those by car. They want to capture 11 million of them, they say.
And why isn't it going out of Los Angeles like Union Station?
Well, it would be a lot more expensive to build. It would be a lot more time consuming. They'd have to get a lot more regulations. If you followed, which I'm sure you have, the public high-speed rail that goes, is supposed to go from the Bay Area to Los Angeles. That's a big part of why that thing seems to be taking forever and, is subject to all these delays. Basically, by doing this, they can stay in the highway median the whole time. They don't have to worry about crossing in and out of traffic. They don't, they don't have to worry about as many environmental permits. It's just a lot easier, a lot cheaper, and a lot quicker.
Well, cheap being relative, because I understand there's a $12 billion price tag, correct?
Yeah.
So who's paying
cheap
for it?
In the world of high-speed rail infrastructure, that's definitely a relative term.
So who's paying for that? $12 billion.
We are paying for some of it. You, me, everybody in the United States. The Biden administration has given them $3 billion of the money that they've been trying to spend to get high-speed rail jump started in the United States. They've also helping them out with $3.5 billion in tax-exempt bonds. That's not a direct contribution. It just makes it easier for them to do their financing. But it's definitely a lot of taxpayer money involved. The Florida project did not require as much taxpayer money.
And so we've got taxpayer money and the feds involved, and also the state. Is the state kicking in money?
I believe they are. I don't have the final figures on that. Nevada is the driver in this one.
Uh-huh.
But California, both states are supportive of it, but California is putting more of their eggs, in the other basket,
right,
the other high-speed rail train.
Right. Okay, so speaking of the other high-speed rail train, this does raise that issue again. And I don't know, what is going on with that?
I mean, that got a lot of federal money, too, in the same tranche that this got a few months ago. They say they're going, but, it's taking time. And there are a lot of people, certainly outsiders, who are very skeptical that the whole line is going to get complete.
And what about this one? Is this one definitely going to be ready in time for the Olympics?
I wouldn't say it's definitely going to be ready in time for the Olympics, but there's a lot of hope, even from people who aren't involved in the project who've been watching this, and that they believe this is going to be the first one to go in the country. This will be the model project. That's why, Buttigieg was there today. The Biden administration, which is really gung-ho on high-speed rail, they want this to be the showcase project. They've set 2028 as the goal because that's the Olympics, but, it's already been subject to delays. And with these kinds of things, you can usually bet that there will be delays.
Right. And so are there other projects or other places in the country waiting to see what this will look like before they go ahead with it?
It's not necessarily before they go ahead with it, but it will make it easier for them, especially, if you wanted to raise private money for financing, but even if you want to build public support to show that one can run in the United States. So many people who love high-speed rail talk about how it works well in Asia and in Europe, and if only more people could see it, they'd be just as enthusiastic. So the hope is that this will build public support. There are projects, and there's one in Texas that's had a lot of hurdles. Part of the thing here, being a private company that's doing this, they can cherry pick what they think is the best place to do it. And they have a definite model for what they think will work. So it may not work as well other places. We're a spread out country. It's not easy to do. They want two big cities that have, the draw that, for tourists and business, that are sort of close enough to do it in a reasonable amount of time and, beat an airplane and beat driving, but also congested enough to make it worth it for people. And, that people will fork over the money, because if you're going to be spending this much money to go round trip, you're either going to be, having a real big weekend in Vegas, or you're going to be going on business if you're going to be spending a few hundred bucks each way.
Right. Maybe you won't be taking the return leg after a weekend in Vegas. Maybe you'll be walking home.
Exactly. That's a one-way ticket.
Noah Bierman, staff writer for the LA Times. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Coming up, Eric the Architect is here. He has his first solo album after years with the Flatbush Zombies. Our conversation is next on Press Play. This is Press Play on 89.9 KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand.
Lust or life. You can choose. Lust or life. You can choose. Birkin Bay, birthday cake, blunted. Drop her off, no record stunting. Immature, slam the door, frontin'. London or Tokyo, we coming. Constantly on my mind, running. All this worry gotta mean something. All this jewelry gotta mean something. Off the wall, I'm just being.
Musician and rapper Eric Elliott, better known as Eric the Architect, on the track Shook Up. It's from his debut solo album, I've Never Been Here Before. Eric's first group is the psychedelic hip-hop trio Flatbush Zombies. But the last several years have brought a big change, with Eric moving to L.A. and stepping out on his own. His new album features some big-name collaborators such as James Blake and George Clinton of Parliament Funkadelic. The album ranges from hip-hop to house to psychedelic soul, and Eric the Architect joins me now. Welcome.
Hello there. How are you?
I'm great. How are you? How are you feeling?
I'm feeling good. I'm about to have my midday brunch or breakfast. On tour, I'm a little bit more conscious of what I eat just because every day is a different city, so you kind of got to be more conscious of what you're putting in your body.
Right. And plus, it's just you up there, right, on stage these days?
It's just me. I have my band, which is two ladies called the Archangels. So I'm not totally by myself, but yeah.
Okay, so describe how that's different from your previous iteration when you were with the Flatbush Zombies.
Well, you know, Flatbush Zombies, we have raw rock star energy where, you know, we pretty much go up there and tear the block down, you know. But this is more like it's a narrative, it's a story that kind of begins when I was a child and talks about my introduction to music, how my family inspired me. Even though they weren't musicians themselves, each one had their own special taste in music, and I was always listening. I was like, man, like, I want to be like that one day. Like, and as much as I hid it from my family, I was secretly crushing on the idea of being an artist. So on stage, all of it is live, so there's stuff that can change. Every show is unique and different from the one previously. And of course, there's like a preset thing that we do, but it's really dependent on the audience interaction with me. It goes from monologues to performances.
Wow, sounds fantastic. So I want to pick up on something you just said. When you were growing up with your family who loved music, but they weren't musicians, and you said you hid the fact that you wanted to be an artist from them. Why did you do that?
Because I was good at other things, you know, and I was doing graphic design and animation and coding and really nerdy computer stuff, which I'm still good at. And he kind of wondered why I wanted to throw that all away to, you know, live in a car and drive around the world and make a dream come true. It seemed like kind of silly when you're a kid until you kind of really make your parents and your family understand that this is something that you're going to do regardless of their approval or not. You know, I'm coming up at a time where a lot of people who were rapping were talking about things that I wasn't doing. I just had a different story, and my mom specifically didn't really understand where I fit in that. So she's like, well, what are you doing? What are you talking about? And I'm like, well, you know, music is, it could be applicable to anything, any situation, if you know what you want to say. And
And your parents are from Jamaica, right?
My dad is. My mom is from New York.
Uh-huh. And you grew up in Flatbush?
Flatbush, Brooklyn.
Hence the name Flatbush Zombies.
Yes, exactly.
I want to play a song now that you have a very famous collaborator with you, so it's not just you. And this one's called Ezekiel's Wheel, and it features George Clinton of Parliament Funkadelic.
My good intentions. What's the meaning of sport?
Oh my gosh. So there he is doing some of the vocals there. How did you connect with George Clinton, who's in his 80s now?
Obviously, I mean, if you know music, I feel like his impact on hip hop music is just,
yeah,
ridiculous. His influence on music is ridiculous. So I've always been a huge fan of Parliament. You know, when I first wrote the record, I worked with my friend Matt, who produced the song, and my friend Rude Cat. I originally wrote the song kind of in a flow state. I was taking a flight. I started to write this narrative of growing up and going to school and, like I said, kind of hiding this talent that I had from my family, kind of out of embarrassment or shame. I was like, wow, like all these things came to me really quick. I wrote the song. And when I landed, Rudy was the first person I thought about contacting about the song. And he was like, man, like this has a really psychedelic feel. And I was like, man, you know, it'd be crazy. And we got George Clinton. And he said, you think we could? And I was like, we can't ever rule anything out. About a possibility, we never know in the world who's listening to you. And I lie to you not. Maybe 2 weeks later, I got a phone call from a friend of mine who runs a clothing line, and they wanted me to shoot with George Clinton as like a photo shoot, him and I together.
No, just randomly? They didn't know that you wanted to work with him on your music?
Not at all. And the other thing was the portion of it that he recorded on, because we wanted him on it so bad before I knew that this phone call was going to come through, we did an imitation of what he might say. When I met him, I talked about music and we took the photos and I said, hey, man, like you probably hear this all the time, but like I'm a huge fan. My mom put me on your music and I would love your blessing to get on my album. And he said, yeah, sure. No problem. I was like, what? He didn't even hear the record yet. He was like, whatever it is, I know it's going to be good. You know, you're a good dude. And I sent it to him. I think he was finishing a tour. So it took a bit for him to send it back to me. And the portion I asked him to do was just a small part, but he was so inspired by the record that he recorded over the whole thing. And I still remember just that morning when I woken up, I was just like, I can't believe this is in my inbox right now.
Incredible. Wow. That's so great. And then also you have some other collaborators, Channel Trace, who's from Compton.
Yeah, my brother.
And so let's play a little song here. It's called a little bit from the song Ambrosia, where you're collaborating with Channel Trace.
Hey, Ambrosia, if we don't catch a vibe, then it's over. I don't got no time for no hit it one time. She frozen.
Hey, I don't know what it is to be lacking. Left early because I got to beat the traffic. Skirt, but the fringes on your shirt. It don't match, but somehow you make it work.
Make it work.
Forecast clear, says Alexa. I love you, but you need a little extra. Thirst trap, it's real desperate. You don't stress it, and that's what makes you special. Little spritz of cologne for the dome. CDG habits, pop tag from the stove. Name a full meal, silverware on the stove. You had a long night, trust I bring you back home. Made a good impression on you, that's a bad.
There's something really California about that, I have to say. Do you feel like you've gotten some California sound in this album by, I don't know, osmosis or just by working with people who live here?
There's a certain energy that's in California that really was prevalent in this album because that's where I live. And, you know, as much as I missed so much about New York while making this, you know, most of it was made in my living room at home. Hanging with guys like Channel is just like he shows me and tells me about the Compton and Los Angeles culture, you know, and even my friends from far, Romeo from far is from L.A., Highland Park area. So it's like I have no choice but to be like kind of submerged in the culture. And because I New York is an amalgamation of all color, all cultures. So one of my best assets is really to find myself no matter where I am, you know. So I think the freedom of California as far as like how far everything is from each other and just, you know, you can walk 10 minutes and see some mountains. It's like, we'll go to the beach. Those definitely helped my writing and made me feel less contrived or trapped by some of the things that might have been maybe holding me back a bit in New York City. But it's also refreshing to go back to New York and get that flavor too, because that's duality of life, you know. And I would never turn my back on where I'm from, but I do think there's some definitely California roots in this album.
Well, speaking of roots, we talked about your dad being from Jamaica and you grew up in a Jamaican neighborhood or a neighborhood that has a lot of Jamaicans in it in Brooklyn, Flatbush. And as an homage to where your dad comes from in Jamaica, a town called Mandeville, you created this alter ego. Can you talk about that?
So, yeah. Mandeville is in Jamaica, as you said. It's a bit deeper into Jamaica. It's in the mountains. So it's a mountainous region where you know, as much as people go to resorts in Jamaica and all that, Jamaica's still poverty. It's still quite prevalent there. Last year, we went on a family trip, and before we were preparing to go, I was in the car kind of just rambling about how much I can't stand music and how rap music is just in a weird place. And I was with my girl, and I think I said something like, I don't remember what I said. It was definitely not kosher. And she was like, I feel like you're in your villain era. And I said, why you think I'm a villain? That's not good. She's like, no, it's good. Like, I like when you let people know how you feel about these things, because I'm sure the people feel the same way. And I almost feel like you're the man, the villain. And I was like, yeah, I like that. And then all these like moments started to come to me where I was like, well, instead of denying that's how I feel sometimes, I'm going to adopt that. And that's going to become an alter ego that I tap into when I feel insecure. Or I feel like I'm doing too much or doing too little. There's a unwilling part of you that says, well, this is okay because you really feel this way. And you have to sometimes champion your own ego because it's so easy to get distracted by other people's lives and what they want. So I created this character, how he looked, how he talked. And a lot of times I changed my voice in the album.
So I know you like professional wrestling. Is the Mandavillain the heel?
He's definitely a heel. He's cheating to win. he's hitting people with belts and weapons. Yeah, exactly.
It's nice to have both in you.
Yeah.
As long as you keep the Mandavillain in control.
Yeah, you can't always be that way.
Can you do the Mandavillain's voice right now?
Kiss me teak, y'all in no way after me eat. There you go.
Oh, I love it. You know, we have that track lined up already, Beef Patty. So let's hear it, because we have it queued up.
Let's do it.
Chuck, kiss me teak, y'all in no way after me. 2x9, me need more time for free. Champion sound, nobody tell me y'all to do it. And no go so make plenty machine. Trigger, finger, trigger.
Chum, free the girl, name my wine, brandy khaki. Man, I shot a shot, I move out of air natty. Oh, leap of them, want to see me in a chatty. She chat to poppy, make her want me beef patty. Trigger tune for the girl, them a wine for the khaki. Man a shot, a move out of air natty. Only for them want to see me in a chatty. How she chat to poppy.
That's the song Beef Patty from my guest Eric the Architect's new album. And so you're seen there in patois.
Yep.
Wow. What are you saying?
I'm saying a lot of things. I'll teach you one thing. In patois, we take a lot of words and we cram them together. I don't know why. I don't know if it's a rhythm thing or just like maybe to sound cool, but like the word do it. We don't say do it. You say do it. So do it. And if you say you don't want to, you say mina afi. So if I say I don't want to do it, I would say mina afi do it.
Mina afi do it.
Yeah.
Oh, I love it. It sounds so nice, actually. It doesn't sound confrontational. Oh, mina afi do it.
You're actually really good at it. That was really good.
Okay, so James Blake produced that, right?
He did.
How did you get connected with him?
I've known him. So I lived in LA for 4 years. This summertime will be, I think, coming up on almost 5 years. I met him before I moved to LA. He was one of the people that actually was a catalyst of me moving. He had did a radio interview or something. I forget what it was. And I've been listening to him since I was in college. So it's just funny because he's always been somebody that I looked up to. And I think the interview, he says that I was one of his favorite producers and he wanted to work or something like that. And my friend had sent it to me. He's like, dude, you know, James Blake is a fan. And I was like, really? He came to the show with his girl. And that's when I met him. And it was from then on. It was just like you kind of get that feeling that this person is more than just this moment. I kind of foresaw that we would become friends. And beyond the music, he's somebody I still can call and talk to about literally everything, anything I'm going through, and vice versa for him, too. And that made the music really easy to make. James and I have made most of the music on this album in less than an hour and a half. You know, this record, we made this one. Beef Patty was probably like 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning at his house. And he played that riff. And I was like, yo, this sounds like some reggae. And then we wrote this song. I recorded it. And I remember one particular thing he told me was, when you rap or, you know, when you sing on this part, use a different part of your voice. And I think that's kind of unconsciously when I started to create this character, because I did it in a lower register first. Kiss me teak, y'all in no way after me. Too bad mind me need more time for free. And he said, do a higher. So I said, kiss me teak, y'all in no way after me. Too bad mind me need more time for free. And he's like, that's it. And then we were like, yo, this is crazy. And he's like, did I just make a dancehall tune? And I was like, yeah, man. Like, it's the first time for both of us to do something like that, which was makes the story even more impactful, you know?
All right. Well, I guess we have to end here.
Do we?
You know, Afi do it, but I have to. Oh my gosh. Okay. Well, Eric, it's been so much fun. Thank you for coming on the show and good luck on tour.
Thank you so much.
That's Eric Elliott. He makes music as Eric the Architect, and his new album is called I Have Never Been Here Before. He's performing here in Los Angeles at El Cid in Silver Lake on May 1st.
Watch me spin in cycles in my dream.
And that'll do it for us today on a Monday. Don't forget to follow us on the socials at KCRW. I'm at The Mad Brand. Thank you for listening, and I'll see you here again tomorrow.